From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Alma Katsu, the author of The Hunger, The Taker, The Reckoning, and The Descent. She has been a signature reviewer for Publishers Weekly and a contributor to The Huffington Post. She's a graduate of the Master's Writing Program at the Johns Hopkins University and received her bachelor's degree from Brandeis University. Prior to the publication of her first novel, Katsu had a long career as a senior intelligence analyst for several U.S. agencies. She lives outside of Washington, D.C. with her husband. Her new novel is The Deep, which puts an eerie psychological twist on one of the world's most renowned tragedies, the sinking of the Titanic and the ill-fated sail of its sister ship, the Britannic. Someone or something is haunting the ship. Between mysterious disappearances and sudden deaths, the guests of the Titanic have found themselves suspended in an eerie, unsettling twilight zone from the moment they set sail. Several of them, including the maid Annie Hebley, guest Mark Fletcher, and millionaires Madeline Astor and Benjamin Guggenheim, are convinced there's something sinister, almost otherworldly, afoot. But before they can locate the source of the danger, as the world knows, disaster strikes. Years later, Annie, having survived that fateful night, has attempted to put her life back together. Working as a nurse on the sixth voyage of the Titanic's sister ship, the Britannic, newly refitted as a hospital ship, she happens across an unconscious Mark, now a soldier fighting in World War I. At first, Annie is thrilled and relieved to learn that he, too, survived the sinking, but soon Mark's presence awakens deep-buried feelings and secrets, forcing her to reckon with the demons of her past, as they both discover that the terror may not yet be over. When I spoke with Alma Katsu, I asked how she came to write The Deep, and if she'd always known about the Titanic's sister ship, the Britannic, about which I have to admit I knew nothing until I read her book. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I wondered if we could start by just talking about how you came to write The Deep, and I didn't know about the Britannic. I'm wondering if you always knew about that ship.
No.
Okay.
So this is something that sort of surprises people. I get the question a lot, you know, were you always a Titanic buff? And the answer is no. So funnily enough, my brother was when he was a little kid, when we were young. And, you know, little boys, they're always interested in something passionately. And then a week later, it's something else. You know, it's gorillas, and then it's sharks, and then it's the Titanic. And I just remember as a kid thinking, oh, that's just a silly boy thing. And so I skipped that entirely. And so fast forward 50 some odd years, my husband was watching a documentary on the dive to the Britannic. And I was walking through the living room and I heard them mention that it was the sister ship of the Titanic. And I didn't know there was a sister ship to the Titanic. So I sit down to start watching it with them. And they mentioned that there was a woman who survived both sinkings. And I knew right then that there had to be a story in it. I didn't know what her story was, but that was just too good to pass up. So that's really the birth of The Deep.
Okay, that's wonderful. And did you use her real name in writing the book?
So that woman is Violet Jessop.
That's Violet, okay.
Yep, Titanic fans will probably recognize. And what ended up happening was I sort of modeled the main character, Annie Hebley, on her. But one of the things I kind of learned from writing The Hunger is, you know, some people are very uncomfortable if you take too many liberties with a real person's life.
Right.
And Violet was well known enough that I did feel like I couldn't project so much onto her. Right. So I sort of used her as a role model in a lot of respects, but she appears in the book too. She's a friend of Anne Hebley.
Yes. I liked her and I wondered if she was based on a historical character. That was kind of fun. I want to talk about prologues. You have the prologue and it's just so wonderfully enticing and suspenseful. It made me really jump right into the book. And I wanted to know what you think as an author of when a prologue is going to be serving the book well and when perhaps it's unnecessary.
Well, you know, so I'm sure if you talk to 50 authors, you'll get 50 different answers. So I'm going to talk from the perspective of a thriller writer.
Right.
Because, you know, every genre has its own demands and reader expectations. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for writers of thrillers, the challenge is to hook them really fast. But then, you know, they're not, they don't really know the characters yet. So it's not that they can really care about the characters. That's not to say you can't seed some tantalizing, you know, start seeding those facts in. But really, you have to end up coming up with something that's going to entice the reader from the beginning and start the forward momentum. And it shouldn't be cheap. You know, it shouldn't just be like an explosion for explosion's sake.
Right.
That has nothing to do with the rest of the book, for instance. So that's sort of the challenge. And especially with thrillers these days, I feel like the ante has really been upped, you know. And so it's really important to try to come up with an inventive and yet, you know, very germane way to start the book and let readers know what they're in for from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, I think what ends up happening sometimes is writers sometimes feel compelled to come up with something that's just that they know will knock readers off their feet, basically. But then when it's not connected to the rest of the book in any meaningful way, that's when readers end up feeling cheated. So that's, I think, the challenge for writers.
Right. Or if it takes too long to get back to that excitement, I think that can be a risk.
Right. Because it's like a red herring then.
Right.
Then they'll like, what the heck?
Yeah.
You know, why did they do that? Why did the writer do that to me?
Now, you just mentioned that sometimes in a prologue, we, you know, we don't know the characters, we don't know the names that are coming up. But one thing I think you do really well is you offer these little small intrigues. This is actually in the bulk of the book, not in the prologue. So, like, for example, I don't think this is too far in, but it's maybe, I don't know, 50 pages in. You have this line, after all, there is still a mission to accomplish. There is still somewhere out there the child, Mark's child. And it's this barely mentioned mystery. And at that point, we don't know anything about who Mark is and what this child is about. There's been just little mentions. And I think that's a really good way of making people, you know, curious and want to keep going. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, that's a hard thing to learn how to do. And I wouldn't even begin to presume that I've learned that lesson at all. I think a lot of it just comes in as you're doing your revisions and you get feedback and, you know, somebody will say, or you'll realize that you've been too long and you haven't, you know, put that hook in. You know, when I talk about what the writing process is like, especially to aspiring writers, I tell them what it's really like is imagine you have a row of little strings in front of you, like several hundred little strings.
Right.
And your job as the novelist is to pull the strings in the precise right order to the exact length, you know, chronologically. And it's impossible to do, right? Like, if you had to make up weaving a rug ad hoc just from a bunch of strings in front of you, for instance, you wouldn't be able to do it. You have to kind of go over it and go over it. And that's the big thing, I think, that makes a really rich book. Is that you have all of these little threads woven through it.
Yeah.
But the little secret is that, you know, you don't do it on a first pass. You have to go back several times. And as you think, rethink those threads too in your subplots and how much weight to give things. And as things complicated as you write the book, then you've got to go back and like pull that little thread through to the exact right degree of emphasis. And it's challenging.
It's hard, right?
Oh, so hard.
Because you don't want to be heavy-handed with it.
That's the toughest thing. I think when we start, we tend to be more heavy-handed.
Yeah.
And it's just as your editors and your agents slap your hand and say, don't be so obvious. You learn not to trust your instincts a little more, maybe.
Yeah, okay, great. Now, you talk about a first pass and then multiple drafts and revisions. Do you always know what's going to happen when you start a first draft, or do you kind of discover it as you go?
Well, you know, I'd written my whole life, but I didn't kind of get back into writing fiction until later in my life. And one of the first things I did was to go into a master's program. And the master's program at that time was very focused on literary fiction. I think nowadays it's not, most of them probably have a little bit more genre writing or commercial writing involved. But at that time, the emphasis was so much on it's got to be organic. I mean, nobody outlined a book.
Right.
I in my master's program, right? It all had to, and I do feel like I write character-driven fiction, but that's sort of the mainstay of literary fiction is that it is absolutely character-driven, and what happens in the book is all a matter of the character, that you know the individual so well, you can see them so precisely, there's no alternative, but they would act the way they would in a certain situation. Mm-hmm. So you come up with the premise and you have the characters, and then you just sort of watch them like a god from on high. Well, you can't do that in a thriller. It's going to be pretty dang boring. You have to plot. So I'm learning to plot more, but I still feel like if I know everything that's happening, the reader won't be surprised. But here's the thing. I don't know. Maybe there's some writers who can pull it all off. But every single one of my books, at some point, an editor or my agent, somebody has come in and said, you really should change this major thing. And that's where the surprise comes from, because then I've got to rewrite like half the book, and it is a surprise.
Yeah, kind of a frustrating surprise.
But, I think it happens to everybody. Honestly, so many writers I talk to, that's what happens.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, then maybe... the knowledge of what's going to unfold comes through in the writing. I mean, I've certainly read books where it's like, it needed a little bit more effort to make this surprising. Yeah.
Okay. Now, The Deep has regular chapters full of prose, but it also has letters and journal entries and some notes and news articles that are kind of like mixed in to the book and give it a little bit of a hybrid appeal. Do you want to talk a little bit about adding those things in?
Well, I think it certainly helps to keep things lively, mm-hmm. as long as it's germane to the story. And especially when you have like an ensemble cast like this, and there's so many extra little things that we needed to bring in, that I needed to bring into the story, that maybe didn't merit an entire point of view chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps break up also, I think, the monotony of, especially in a long book, the monotony of just reading, word brick after word brick after word brick. In this day and age, I think readers, especially thrillers, again, they expect shorter chapters, for the pace to keep going. And if your book doesn't lend itself to being that kind of thriller, sometimes you got to think of other devices that might help you sort of break up monotony, introduce just like a little change up, right? It just kind of like gooses the story a little bit,
right.
Or as a wake up call to a reader to reinvigorate, like a little shot of espresso to perk them up and get them back in. And it's just fun, I think, to introduce a different voice or cadence, rhythm into the writing. It gives you an excuse to do a little bit of research and look at what was the telegram format and conventions of the day? What would a lady doctor's personal journal, how would that read? What would it be? It also just kind of gives you a chance to stretch your muscles a little.
Okay. One thing that I enjoyed about your writing is you make great use of metaphor. And I know that seems kind of simple, but I don't know that everybody does it really well. And you do. And one example, I just loved this moment. It's a tiny little moment, but Annie is arriving at the Britannic. And the line is, Annie claps a hand to her hat as she looks up, up, up at the ship's four huge funnels like turrets on a castle. So I loved that castle analogy, but also that up, 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 it just kind of made me feel the scale of this massive ship. I liked that. I just thought I would mention that and see if you have anything to say about metaphor.
Gosh, well, thank you very much. And the reason why I'm so touched by it is because I, especially early in my writing, I was terrible at metaphor. As a matter of fact, I wrote one book where one person said, you don't have a metaphor in this entire book. That was like 15 years ago, but I have to force myself to remember that a good book is a balance of many things,
yeah.
Regardless of what your writing style is. And, this is part of the things they kind of drum into you when you're in a writing program. Make sure that you have sensory information in there. Don't forget to breathe a little bit and, you break it up with some setting or something like that.
Right.
And so, I constantly am, as I'm going through the additional passes, kind of thinking about, you know, do I have enough of this? Do I have enough of that? It's funny, I was just blurbing a book for somebody, and I mean, it was a completely different kind of thriller. It was supposed to be one of these fast-paced, page-turning thrillers. But honestly, the book was almost entirely written dialogue, like 300 pages of dialogue. And unless your dialogue is amazing, that's going to be weary to a writer. And I didn't say anything to him because that's not my job at this point. The book's done. It's, you know, it's in the page proof stage and stuff. You can't change it. But I just felt like, you know, and he's a young writer. This was his debut. And it's just one of those things that over time you may realize, you know, if I could redo that book, maybe I'd do it a little differently. I know I would write my first book differently if I knew then what I know now.
Do you think it was a purposeful stylistic thing or just sort of just what he gravitates toward?
So this is me being presumptive, but I think it's partly his style, but I think when we start, we kind of lean on crutches, what comes most naturally to us, what we feel most comfortable with, and maybe don't always want to push ourselves as much. And I think an editor should have said to him, I think we need a little more balance here. But I'm not kidding. It was almost 300 pages of dialogue.
I wanted to ask, in the historical accurate, you know, stories of these ships, were there seances and rumors of ghosts on these ships?
So from the research I could find, I didn't see any overt mention of people feeling like there were ghosts on the Titanic. However, I kind of feel like it wouldn't be such a stretch because, among other things, my husband loves to watch the ghost shows on TV, like Ghost Hunters and stuff like that. So I find myself sitting there with them and watching a lot of them. And, you know, a lot of them certainly are old historic buildings. But I swear to God, people will put a ghost story on anything.
Oh, sure.
So it doesn't matter if it's a brand new ship. They'll project ghosts. So I would imagine just because it is sort of an unsettling atmosphere, especially when you get to the lower levels of the ship, you know, in the engine compartments and things like that where guys are working long hours and there's all kinds of mysterious noises, that it would almost be crazy if there weren't ghost stories about it.
Yeah.
Now, as far as seance is concerned, I don't know if anyone held a seance on the Titanic, but that was the age, the end of the Edwardian era, you know, that they were crazy into occultism and spiritualism.
Sure.
You know, especially the upper classes, they were really into that. And one of the characters in the book, in real life, Stead, I mean, in the book, we have him as being an occultist. And in real life, he was huge into that, huge. He knew all of the top spiritualists of the day. And so it was certainly in character that he would have held a seance in his stateroom.
it seemed completely accurate to period, certainly. And I just...
That brings up a good point that I think not only readers, but if you have folks who are, you know, writers of historical fiction, especially if they're sort of like in the early stages, this question comes up a lot. Like, what are the expectations of readers? You know, what does a writer of historical fiction sort of, what are the rules? What do they owe the reader? Mm-hmm. My answer is, I think historical fiction is a very big tent. And so some people have come to my books expecting them to be, you know, like this very faithful retelling of the historical event with just this veneer of fiction on top. And there are certainly plenty of historical fiction writers who approach the genre that way. But I try to be very upfront about it. That's not what I'm doing here, that I'm kind of using the historical event as a springboard for another story. And I'm using this historical event because there's aspects of them, themes or issues that are inherent in the historical event that I want to build on. So, for instance, The Hunger, while it was a retelling of the Donner Party story, the theme of it was monsters. Under what circumstance, what kind of event would push a person to go from man to monster, to do something monstrous? The Donner Party just really lent itself to that. And the same thing with the Titanic. You know, here you have the circumstance where people are going to be pushed to the absolute brink. And there are other issues, issues of the era that I wanted to explore in the book, like the issue of women's suffrage. That's why most of the main characters of the Titanic are women. And whether they're a poor stewardess, like the main character, or Madeline Astor, who was just married to the richest man in America, you see all of them have these constraints on their freedom. you know, societal constraints. What is what they're allowed to do, what they're expected to do in society, whether or not that's what they want to do. And so, you know, that's what I try to use the historical events for, to ask these sort of bigger questions. But I know that's confusing to some readers who are expecting, you know, complete verisimilitude, right? That it's exactly like this. And if that's what people are looking for, I think then these books will be a little disappointing to them. But hopefully they realize that's not the case, because I also try to make very plain that there's this horror or supernatural element, which automatically takes us out of, you know, what probably actually did happen.
Just look at the cover.
Yeah. I hope people realize that. Well, you'd be surprised what people say to you at book events.
Yeah. So, you know, when you mentioned the women's suffrage aspect of it, I thought you established that really well right up front, because we start out where the main character is in an institution. And, you know, it's a mental institution, but even the director says to her, you know, we know you're not really mad that you're just here because we don't know what else to do with you. And it's just, it made me think, oh, gosh, you know, I mean, it was just, it really was a statement about the power women had or did not have at that time.
That was such a common thing to happen to women, even into, you know, deeper into the 20th century. It was very easy for women to be institutionalized at the say-so of a family member, even if there was really no problem, just because they didn't like the way they thought, or they were being too stubborn, or, you know, showing too much will. And it's frightening, really, to think about. And it almost seems like it must be pure fiction, you know, from the vantage point of today, at least in Western society. But you know, we need to remember that life was very, very different not even so long ago.
Yeah, true. Alma, I like to ask all my guests what they've been reading lately that they might recommend to listeners. Have you read any books that you'd like to share with us?
You know, since The Hunger saw the success that it did, for which I'm extremely grateful,
right,
somehow that's kind of put me on the blurb circuit. So I do get a lot of requests to read books and, you know, provide a blurb. So they may not have been books that I necessarily like that are quite exactly in my wheelhouse. I have read a couple. One is The Return by Rachel Harrison. I think it's a debut. I'm pretty sure it's a debut. I think it just came out. And that was very well done. It's, you know, thriller writers come up with the most interesting premise. And the premise of this is there's a group of four friends, and I think it's a year earlier, one of the friends disappeared, just completely disappeared. And they never found out what happened to her. The husband didn't know, the family didn't know, the friends didn't know. They were beating themselves up over it. And then suddenly she reappears with no recollection of what happened to her.
Oh, wow.
And and then the friends get together as an opportunity to see her, and they realize that this isn't her. And yet it's her. So there's this puzzle box, this crazy puzzle box. And if that appeals, I really suggest folks pick that book up. There's, I don't know if it's out yet in the United States, there's a book called The Lost Village by a Swedish writer. Her name is Camilla Sten, S-T-E-N. It's out already in Europe, and I'm not sure what the release date's looking like for the U.S. But, you know, speaking of reality shows, there's so many of those shows where, you know, crews go back to, you know, a deserted place, you know, like Chernobyl or something. My husband loves those shows, too. Josh Gates. So Josh Gates will go into these creepy, deserted places where there's a lot of folklore, and, you know, stay overnight and film. So that's sort of the premise here. It's a woman who actually has a personal connection to this village that 50 years earlier, everyone in the village just disappeared overnight, except for the body of one villager was found, obviously, I think, stoned to death, and no explanation of what happened. And they had recovered a baby that had obviously just been born at the scene. So again, one of these incredible puzzle boxes. So if you like that kind of story, Disappearing Village, I think readers would really like that. That's The Lost Village by Camilla Sten.
Wonderful. Those both sound great. Thank you.
So many good thrillers.
Yeah. Let's see. I always like to finish up by asking my guests for advice for writers, because there are a lot of writers that listen to the show. And in your case, I wanted to just mention something that you say, I think in your acknowledgments, you write, there's an avalanche of material available on the Titanic, a boon, but also a challenge to the novelist. So I wonder if you have any advice for conducting research.
Oh, I have so much advice. So much that I actually developed a workshop, because after The Hunger, I always got questions about what was my research process. And I think I might have something different to offer, because I actually was a researcher for 35 years for the government in intelligence. I was an analyst, which is basically a researcher, which is completely different from a historian. And I've worked with historians. The purpose of research is different than the purpose of a historian's research. And so I think I've learned a lot about like the process of how to do research, especially more efficiently. So that there's a couple things I would say, and particularly if you have readers who are, or listeners who are thinking about historical research, my main piece of advice is you don't have to approach it like a historian, because I do think a lot of writers feel pressure to do that incredibly thorough search, like they're going to write their own reference document, but that's not what you're doing. The story should always come first. And believe it or not, I hear this a lot. It's like, oh, I wanted to write a book about World War II, but I didn't know what it was going to be about. So I just read every book I could find on World War II. That is absolutely not the most efficient approach to writing a book. And if you have 10 or 15 years to dedicate it to it, have at it, but I don't. So scope your book first, figure out what it's going to be about, and you can do like a little brief research, but the scope necessarily have to come out of historical context. And then once you know what the scope is about, figure out what are the biggest pits of your ignorance, basically. Find the best books to address that and limit your preliminary research to that. Finish your plotting and then just do spot research as you go along. But I think the thing that I heard over and over again in talking to people was, you know, a lot of folks hadn't really done a research project since college or even high school. And it was very daunting to them. And, you know, they have it in their heads. They got to use index cards and all this stuff. And you don't. You don't. And I get a lot of pushback from people, especially historical fiction writers, who have it ingrained in them that they have to be amateur or semi-professional historians. And you just don't. I mean, no one really cares. And a lot of times when you take that approach, that's how you end up with a book that's just so full of meaningless historical detail that it bogs the story down.
Wonderful. That's great advice. Just being able to start out by figuring out what the scope of the project is going to be and not opening up yourself to so much. Because I think one of the problems is if you do so, and this is what you were saying about the challenge of the novelist, when there's too much research available, you have the tendency or the temptation to use it all, and that's boring. Like, nobody wants everything in there. So
absolutely. And I know we can all point to best-selling books where the author is guilty of this sin, but you know, it depends on what kind of book you want to write. But, you know, I've really been sort of gratified by the response I get from readers about how rich and immersive they feel the books are. But I also don't feel like I, you know, do these expositional chunks, as Ursula Le Guin would say, you know, where you're just dropping in this avalanche of fact about things to anchor down your story. You know, I try to do it lightly and really pick out the facts that matter. And they matter because they're absolutely germane to the character, not necessarily because it's just something that happened in that period of history.
Yeah. And I also think you're really good, and maybe this is related, at using a set of spare but accurate details to fill in what readers already know. So, for example, you know, we all know something about the Titanic, but you had this great paragraph. Do you mind if I read a paragraph?
Oh, no, please.
So you have this paragraph. What does she remember about her time on the Titanic? All she has to do is close her eyes and it comes back to her. The halls and the bustle and the noise, the fears and the whispers and the secrets, the hidden wanting, the thrash of the waves against the side of the boat, so far below the deck that their foam seemed like a trick of the light and not the deadly cold it really was. The falling, the screams, the darkness of the night, and the little rescue flares bobbing uselessly until one by one they died out. So that was absolutely beautiful, and it filled in what I already knew, but with something very sort of, it just visceral, you know?
Oh, well, Well, thank you. And hopefully it conveyed, you know, her mindset.
Yes.
What she would have, you know, it really conveyed character.
Yeah.
Because that is how she thinks of it. But if you ask like an 86-year-old woman passenger who was just taking tea on the deck every day, you know, how she would think of the Titanic might be completely different.
True.
So, I mean, I do think that's a good example of maybe how, you know, how to put yourself in to writing more character-driven as opposed to just, you know, writing. Writing about the Titanic, for instance, yeah.
Yes. Well, Alma, I want to thank you very much. I want to just mention again, the book is The Deep, published by Putnam, and Alma Katsu is the novelist. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. So much fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, host of Write the Book, a show for writers and curious readers. That was a conversation with Alma Katsu. You can learn more about her work at almakatsubooks.com. For a new Write the Book prompt, I'd like to reiterate Alma's advice about research. Narrow your focus before delving in too deeply. Keep it manageable for you and your readers. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please tune in each week for more prompts and great conversations about books and writing. As we live through this quarantine in which the entire world is basically on lockdown, I hope that you are able to read and write. And if possible, I hope you are able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. And for all of you who are trying to write while in isolation, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you enjoy the show, please do rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. That's how people hear it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.